Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree down in North Carolina.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. That's Rhiannon Giddens. And today, we're bringing you a replay of a conversation we had with her back in October of 2019, on the morning of a concert she performed that night here in Charlotte. Remember live music? That was fun. Giddens' musical life has covered an extraordinary range, from string band music with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, to operas she has performed and written, to the global roots music she's exploring with her partner Francesco Turisi. Their new album, titled It's Calling Me Home, comes out next month. She's also a member of the group Our Native Daughters, with three other black female banjo players. She acted in the TV series Nashville, and was a featured commentator in Kim Burns' series on country music. In this episode, we explore how Giddens' background in a multiracial, multicultural family laid the groundwork for her lifelong search of the musical roots that connect us all. But we start out talking about something else that connects many Southerners, our food. In particular, for Giddens, the K&W Cafeteria, in our hometown of Greensboro, North Carolina. Here's our conversation. So what is it that attracts you so much? I know I've been there many times myself. The food's good. Mm-hmm. What else is it about the place?
Well, for me, it's just Greensboro. Like, it just represents my hometown. And, you know, it's just people from all kind of different walks of life are there. And people that I am, you know, it just kind of represents my people, I guess. You know, it's a lot of working class folks and just in there for a good meal, and black and white and brown. And it's just, I don't know. I just always feel very home there. I mean, I've been going there for a long time, but I walk in, I'm like, this is, it kind of represents the thing about being home that speaks to me, yeah. You know, and I just see the people's faces and I'm like, I know these people, you know.
You were exposed to so much different kinds of music, different places you lived and all that stuff growing up. Do you feel like you were chasing any of that? Or did you just happen to get exposed to a lot of stuff along the way that sort of shaped what your musical taste is now?
Yeah, I mean, I think being mixed is part of it. You know, I'm very used to sort of shuttling back and forth across cultural lines. And so I think that gives me a kind of openness about what does it mean to belong, and what does it mean to not feel like you belong, and what does it mean to code switch, and all of that goes into music. You know, it's the idea of being open, I think, to, well, that kind of music, I can listen to that kind of music, and I can listen to this kind of music. It's not an either-or proposition. So I do think that kind of growing up within, you know, the two communities, you know, it influenced, you know, how I kind of looked at the world, you know, in terms of just, there was nothing kind of off limits for me.
And did you feel like you were able to sort of translate, like when you were at somebody's house and you could play something that you heard at the other house and kind of turn people on to different things? Did that ever work?
I mean, I don't know if I ever did that, but I'm well used to, because the thing is that, you know, if you think about the two sides of my family, for example, I mean, they're not that different. I mean, that's the other part of it. It's like, on the one hand, I was used to kind of negotiating the traveling between these two worlds. But then the older I get, the more I kind of go, well, actually, they really weren't that different, you know? So it's kind of an odd thing. It's like on the surface, there's this idea of difference. But, you know, as we all know, I mean, race is a construct. I mean, it's absolutely no biological thing for it. So, but then what happens is that it gets kind of baked into cultural differences, and it gets baked into how you look at the world. So it's like simultaneously going, yeah, I was kind of going from one side to the other, but then realizing that those sides were actually not that far apart.
Right,
you know?
Right. And did you feel that there was maybe more of a difference, like kind of a rural-urban sort of
that's
thing?
The older I get, the more I feel like there was more of a difference. Like when I went to Ohio for school, and I was like, whoa, this is different. You know, I was in Northern Ohio. And I was like, wow, okay, so there's regional differences. And then, you know, for me, like I was in the rural situation first when I was really young, and then, you know, when I got older, we moved into downtown, into Greensboro, but I was still going out to, basically staying with both sides of, you know, my grandparents, like, for large chunks of time and going out there a lot. So it's still, so I kind of feel I kind of grew up in between the two, you know. I have aspects of both, but if I had to pick one, you know, in terms of being most comfortable, it's definitely that rural idea, because that was my first kind of experience. But I do kind of feel like that is more of a difference, you know, than sort of a racial difference out, you know, if you have a black folk and white folk out in the country. Like, to me, culturally, it's not that big of a difference. But then as soon as you step into the city, then, you know, I think the differences transcend race, you know. But what we do now is we attach these different aspects of things to race, even though there's some things that are actually pan-Southern or pan-rural, you know. And that's the same exact thing in the music. So, you know, as I've sort of been doing my research and kind of discovering how this narrative of American music has been co-opted and how it's been sort of, the true narrative has been erased and there's been one that's been put in its place, you know, I realize that it's the same thing that happens, you know, in just the culture of the South. You know, the culture of the South is a pan-Southern culture that has aspects of, you know, the European and African cultures that went into, you know, the people here, plus the native, you know, element, which people always forget about. You know, there were people here when people got here, you know, and they are also a big part of, you know, this pan-Southern culture. And people tend to, because of how the American narrative has been written in the last, you know, 100 years, you know, people associate this with white people and this with black people, and, you know, and really, it's this mix that has then produced this idea of what it is to be in the South, and that really is shown in the music.
Do you feel like if you'd grown up in Ohio or Montana or somewhere like that, that this would not resonate as much with you? Is this sort of connection, this sort of cultural connection, is the South where it happened?
I mean, it's absolutely a big part of why I do what I do. You know, I feel, where I live, where I grew up, you know, for me, like, investigating the music and the history was my way of reconciling who I was, you know, because I did grow up feeling kind of neither fish nor fowl. When I discovered Joe Thompson and when I discovered this whole vast history of black string band music and stuff that I'd always been drawn to ever since I got home from college, oh my gosh, this makes sense to me as a Southerner. And I realized that was my identity, is really, it's not a white or black or mixed person, is a Southerner, is a North Carolinian. And that was kind of a big piece. It was a big piece of me kind of coming to terms with, you know, who I am and who I've become, you know.
That moment's become sort of legendary, and the people who are your fans of you meeting Joe Thompson at this black banjo convention, and that's where the Carolina Chocolate Drop sort of formed and all that sort of thing. And I think people who know you kind of know that story. What I don't know as much is sort of, what did that feel like to you? Did it feel like sort of you found what you've been looking for a while, or did it have some, what emotions did it sort of bring up in you?
Well, I mean, I had known Joe was in existence before the Black Banjo Gathering. I had met him once, you know, but the thing that the Black Banjo Gathering did for me, and, you know, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I would guess the other guys, is, you know, we were kind of operating on our own, you know, in our own worlds, you know. And this is also what the Black Banjo then and now listserv, which gave rise to the gathering that was started by Tony Thomas. That was also kind of a safe space for people to be, you know, because if you went on the banjo listserv and started talking about the black origins of the banjo, you got flamed. I mean, it was really tough. And so Tony Thomas started this whole other spot, Black Banjo Players Then and Now, and that's what kind of started the gathering. And so when we all met each other, it was like you had this feeling of, oh, I'm not the only freak anymore. Like, we're, you know, we're all together, and maybe we're not freaks, actually. And, you know, having the Carolina Chocolate Drops, I feel like it was such a boon to all of us, you know, to be able to go to an old-time gathering and be like, you know, we actually, we have each other, as well as, you know, we're not the one you know, the raisin in the oatmeal, as we like to say, you know.
Part of what you're doing, I guess I should back up for maybe some listeners who aren't as familiar with you and what you've done, Chocolate Drops and Solo. You know, part of what you're doing is sort of revealing this history that had been sort of hidden for a long time.
Yeah.
The banjo is basically an African instrument. So many black bands were string bands that what we think of as country music, bluegrass music, folk music old time were played by African Americans. Are people coming up to you and saying, I never knew any of this before I saw you?
Sure. It still happens. You know, in my world, I've been living with the banjo being an African-American instrument for over, 12 years. And so for me, it's still like, really? I still have to say this? You know, and I do. People still have. It's still, you know, in my mind, it looms so large, but it's because that's what I deal with all the time. But in the average person's consciousness, it's still not a thing. So it's a really big part still of, you know, what I talk about and what I do. But it's, you know, the research is still coming out. You know, like recently there was an article for The New Yorker that it was about me ostensibly, but it starts with this man named Frank Johnson, which is now, and he was completely single-handedly uncovered by John Jeremiah Sullivan, an amazing music writer and ingenious mind. And he discovered this man that once he stumbled over him and he kind of started looking, he's like, he was everywhere. He was just, you know, and it represents how big the black string band was and how important it was for Southern culture. It's the cornerstone, really, of so much Southern music. And the fact that it was erased from the history is just mind-blowing. And so that stuff, that doesn't just happen. That is...
Yeah, I was going to say, when you talk about the narrative was erased and one that was replaced with, that's what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. And it was very deliberately done. And it's, you know, it's the thing of timing, deliberation, the advent of commercial music, all of these things go into it, but people don't realize like how fast this can happen. So it's like there's this idea of the black string band, which is all over the South, you know, and then you have emancipation, you have the advent of leisure class, and you have, you know, the music entertainment complex really kind of growing and growing in America. And then in the 20s, you have three things happening, right? So this is how the narrative gets flipped. So you have what's happening is at the turn of the century, say half of the string bands are black, and then you start having three things happen. One, you have the Great Migration. So African Americans are leaving the South in large numbers because of lynchings, the, you know, not being able to vote. Basically, you know, the people who want to make the South inhospitable to African Americans. You have Ralph Peer, you know, representing the advent of the commercial recording industry. So people are starting to record American music and they want to sell it back to Americans. So he came up with the race and hillbilly records. So he's separating white rural people like to listen to string band music and black rural people like to listen to blues. It was a decision that he made based on, there were some predilections going on there, but, you know, ultimately people listen to everything. Somebody like Jimmy Rogers, who has all these blue inflections in, and you know, and there's black string bands still playing like what we would call hillbilly music. This was still happening, you know. But then you have people coming in and going, these are the record bins. So you're going to listen to this, and you're going to listen to this because it's easier to sell you music. Then you also have people like Henry Ford, who was a noted xenophobe and racist, you know, responding very strongly to the advent of blues and jazz and going, well, that's jungle music. We got to get this canker out of our American character. And so he's basically, him and people like him are saying, you know, well, we need to rally around white cultural music. And that turned out to be string band music and square dancing. Square dance calling, you know, as Phil Jameson has demonstrated in his book, Roots and Branches of American Dance, was most likely invented by African Americans, right? So,
and I remember hearing that you kind of, as a younger woman, did like contra dance calling.
I used to call, and I used to feel like a freak because I was like, I was the only one. I didn't realize I was part of this vast tradition of black string band musicians and callers and dancers, you know? And so, you know, you got people like this, you know, and they're coming up with these fiddle competitions. So you can win a prize if you're the best fiddler, where in a lot of these places, the best fiddlers were black, but blacks couldn't enter. So it's basically a forced segregation of American music and a combination with the demographic shift and the advent of the recording industry. So what gets recorded is not necessarily a reality of the time, but that's what we have. So if you don't know the history, when you listen to the recordings, you think one thing, even though there were still black string bands being recorded back then, just not in the numbers that they would have been in, and you start going, oh, this is what it looks like. You know, but it's a false reality. It feeds into these notions that we're actually fundamentally different people, that America wasn't formed on a consensus of cultural mixing, that it was formed on these, you know, where everybody was in their box from the beginning, which is total BS. I mean, it's like, so it's beyond BS. It's like, you know, you scratch the history and you're like, whoa, that's really not true. But it's an easy narrative to feed to people. And it, you know, it just keeps this idea of, well, we're fundamentally different, so let's not try to even mix it up.
An old friend lay on his dying bed, held my hand to his bony breast.
When we come back, Rhiannon Giddens talks about how music is one of the key ways human beings can find common ground.
That there is this commonality of the human experience that we find represented over and over again in music and in cultural artifacts and art. And the way that we express ourselves is very diverse, but the common core of who we are is the same.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey y'all, if you're a fan of Southbound, then you're going to want to check out WFAE Studios. It's a new podcast feed where you'll hear investigative series, public conversations, and special reports from WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source. It's the place where you'll find projects like Asbestos Town, David Borax's recent series on an old textile mill in Davidson, North Carolina, that's dragging up painful memories. Get a deep look at the news that impacts our community. Make sure to follow WFAE Studios on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or your favorite listening app. Now, back to Southbound and my conversation with Rhiannon Giddens. I remember talking to a friend of yours. You were living in like their garage apartment when you guys won a Grammy, and then you did this show where you sang Waterboy and did the Gaelic stuff and got really known there. Then all of a sudden you're like writing music for like these unfinished Dylan songs, all this craziness. And it looked from the outside like, wow, that's, you know, you jumped on the express train. Mm. What did it feel like to you?
Well, it felt like a lot of work. You know, I mean, I was older than the other Chocolate Drops, you know, by about 5 years. And you know, I'd gone to school for opera and I'd worked, like, I basically have been obsessed with music since I was 18 years old, you know, and have done nothing but do that since I was 18. And whether it was opera or Celtic music or, you know, black string band music or whatever, I've been obsessed with this. And so for me, it was just kind of like, you know, we were very lucky, the Chocolate Drops, in terms of how we got sort of discovered, but we also put in a lot of hours on the road. We were doing, you know, I got pregnant and had a baby on the road like 250 days a year, like carried that child, nursing that child, you know. So for me, it was a lot of work. And so I just kind of had to, I just tried to hold on, you know. And like people asked me even, you know, when T-Bone wanted to do my solo record, how does it feel to do, you know, a solo record at this age, you know, as if I was like, you know, 95. And I was like, well, you know, I'm happy to be doing it, you know, not as a 23-year-old, you know, like I have a perspective on life. I have something to say, you know. So I think for me, I was in the right spot. I was in the right place to kind of take it as it came without bringing it into myself and making that part of my inherent worth as a human being. You know, I think a lot of people start believing the hype and they start believing that they're special and they're different. And I'm like, you know, I'm grateful for everything that's come my way and I work very hard for it, but I'm also aware that it's just grist for the mill. It's just so that I can get this message out there. And like, I myself count very little.
You do so many different things musically. Do you find yourself like getting obsessed with some style or something and then just like digging deep into that for a while? Or do you kind of like, you know, when you hear something that might be new to you and you really love, do you just like obsess over that for a while?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I have done, you know. Like, I got into Scottish music and, you know, also started learning the history of, you know, Highlanders in America and discovering there were, you know, would have been black Gaelic speakers in North Carolina and this huge settlement. And, you know, that just really fascinated me. The work of, you know, Dr. Michael Newton really, you know, has influenced the way I look at Celtic music, I think, in the correct way, you know, because there's a lot of myths that have to be burst around the mythical sort of Celtic person, you know, in the United States. But there's so much of the music in that culture that really called to me, you know, and so I got in there and I went to Scotland and I studied with native speakers and all this kind of stuff and learned a lot from Michael. And, you know, and then as that was kind of winding down, like the, you know, the Joe Thompson connection and the Black String Band, you know, which had always kind of been in the background, really kind of took over. And then it was just like, let me just sit in this, you know. I really believe in kind of really sitting in stuff and learning as much as you can about it. So I tend to get obsessed, you know, and really just be in it. And then once I move on, it's like I pull from that, but I'm into the other thing, but because I sit so deeply into whatever it is that I'm trying to learn, the arms that has are long, and they come in and filter. Like, that's why I'm still doing a Gaelic song now, you know, because the setting for that was deep, you know, and it's a part of who I am now.
The thing that you're dipping into now, There Is No Other, this new record, what would you call that you're dipping into?
Well, now with this record with Francesco, what it does for me is situates what I've been doing with African American music and American music in general in a global context, you know, because what I've been doing with, you know, sort of championing the idea of how integral African Americans have been to American music, which hasn't been talked about, you know, which of course now with the new country music documentary, that needle is going to be moved a bit. But that's kind of been my focus. And, well, Francesco comes from...
Francesco, explain.
Francesco Tirisi, who is my musical partner and who we made this record, There Is No Other. And we met in Ireland, which we're both expats who live in Ireland, you know. And, you know, he comes from the Mediterranean. So his family is all from Sicily. He grew up in Italy. We have a lot of parallels in what we're doing. So putting them together is actually quite easy, you know. And for me, it reminds me that the things that I've been talking about has been happening all over the world for thousands of years. You know, this idea of parallelism and you know, sort of the same, you know, the same issues with humanity keep happening. But I think it's really important to recognize that and to go, you know, we do this again and we do it again, but we can't still stop it, you know, because anything that can be repeated can also be stopped, you know, because you know, you can see it coming, you know, you can learn from times that this has happened in the past and say, well, can we interrupt this pattern? You know, so that's been really amazingly valuable to me to meet somebody like him and to figure out how much of these things, you know, we'd like to say we overlay our music on top of each other and we find all these amazing peaks.
And what would you say are some of those, get it sort of musically, you know, you talked about it sort of culturally and historically, musically, what are the connections that you like feel the deepest, I guess?
Well, one of the first connections we made was in the frame drum, you know, which is not very, very, not very well known here. But a tambourine is a frame drum. You know, a Bowron is a frame drum. And frame drums have been in existence for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and they're all over the world. And he plays a large frame drum that would be very common all over the Mediterranean and North Africa. And you know, I play this minstrel-style banjo, which is from the 1850s, and we discover that those two instruments, just number one, really go together. And when you start looking at the history, you realize that the way that the banjo, you know, went from a homemade gourd instrument to sort of a commercial instrument with a hoop that everybody knows today, you know, may have been influenced by, you know, frame drum tambourines that were coming into. You know, there's actually historical connections that support the musical feelings that we had, which is amazing, you know.
I hadn't thought about that. Like, a banjo is like a tambourine with strings on it, basically.
Basically, and, you know, the first person, Boucher, to do the tension where you have to tighten the banjo all the way around, you know, instead of, like, a tack head gourd, you have, like, a skin and a hoop, and then you have these kind of clips onto it, right? They are exactly the same way that you tightened and changed the tone of a tambourine. that there is this commonality of the human experience that we find represented over and over again in music and in cultural artifacts and art. And the way that we express ourselves is very diverse, but the common core of who we are is the same, you know, and that's kind of what we're talking about. You know, we're not saying that, you know, everybody does things the same way. That's not what we're saying, but how everybody lives and what everybody's afraid of and what everybody loves and all, that's a commonality of the human experience, and it's important to recognize that.
You know, you talked about, you got into this whole string music, so you picked up a banjo and figured out, is that pretty easy for you? Can you pick some up and suss it out?
I definitely have a natural affinity for string instruments, you know, which is what drew me to the fiddle and the banjo, and I'm kind of, I stay with that, you know. Vocally, that's where my elasticity is. You know, I can go a lot of different ways, you know, with the voice, but that's my primary instrument. You know, that's what I've been doing the most. And that I definitely have a kind of a unique ability to go back and forth between classical and vernacular and different folk styles and things. And it's just because of the way that I came to age as a musician. You know, I was interested in doing all these different things and kind of being a chameleon and not knowing what my voice was for a while and then finding it through, you know, making music. But yeah, I mean, I'm sticking to what I know, you know. I'm a singer who plays, you know, a couple instruments, but style wise, I'm very flexible, you know.
One of my favorite little details that I remember about you is you used to sing at Macaroni Grill, right?
Yeah, I did.
And that was it opera basically you were singing?
Yeah, it was my second job. I had a full, you know, 40-hour week desk job, and then I wanted to get a fiddle and a banjo, so it was the only way I knew to make extra money. So they built the one that's still in Greensboro, and I was a singing hostess for about 6 months. I had enough money to get my fiddle, my banjo, and I quit immediately. But yeah, it was like Italian art song from like the 17th century. You know, I wasn't called to do it very much, but I did have memories of singing O Mio Bambino Caro or Caro Mio Ben or whatever for these folks who were kind of like, what is going on right now?
Right. I was going to say, was that after you'd been in Oberlin and been trained?
Oh, yeah.
So you were a trained opera singer doing this. Did anybody ever come up and say, wow, you're, you know, somebody who might have known what they were hearing?
I mean, you know, it's a busy restaurant with, you know, people who wanted me to sing seemed to enjoy it, and they gave me a nice tip, and, you know, nobody came up and was like, oh, my God, you're going to enjoy this. I mean, you know, it's a weird kind of singing for a lot of people anyway, you know. So it was a good experience, though.
Where do people know you from now? Because, you know, you've done the Chocolate Drops, done the solo tour, you acted in the show Nashville. Like, if you get seen on the street, what do people say?
I tell you, TV is a powerful medium, and so now these days I get recognized more than anything for Nashville. Now I'm getting a lot of, oh, I saw you on the documentary, you know, the Ken Burns documentary, which is happening right now. So TV's powerful. Like, I get occasionally, you know, oh, I love your work, and, you know, they would know the Chocolate Drops, or they would just know me as a musician. But, you know, if I get randomly recognized on the street, and especially in, like, say, the UK, where Nashville was really big, or Ireland, you know, it's like, you look just like that girl on Nashville, or you were on Nashville. You know, it's really, for the TV stuff has power, you know. And that's just, I mean, that's just the way it is.
I know the New Yorker story sort of described what I remember seeing when I saw you on there, sort of this magical creature who kind of comes in and, you know, says beautiful, angelic, you know, spiritual things to everybody and sort of lifts everybody up. Did you kind of feel that when you were into it?
I'll say that at the beginning of the Nashville stint, you know, it did have that bit of a feel of the magical Negro, you know, as it's called, where, you know, the black person comes in and is like, let me save this white character from herself, you know. But I'm going to give all the props in the world to Marshall Herskovitz, who was the showrunner for that show, you know, because when he called me in for the audition, I think he, like, that's how the part was written, and then I think he brought me in, you know, because he liked what I did, you know, specifically. Came in for the audition, I brought my banjo, and I was like, this banjo has to be in the show, you know, and I just, I'm bold, you know, because I didn't have anything to lose, you know, and played the banjo, and he was like, that's beautiful, and true to his word, he worked that into the script. So at the beginning, it does have that feel to it, but as the show goes on, Hallie becomes, you know, a real person, and then, you know, he worked in her going to, you know, community center and talking about the banjo to a bunch of black kids. And like, I got to kind of put together a version of the chocolate drops, the Nashville chocolate drops or whatever. And it was just, I was really impressed with his, you know, dedication to, I mean, like, I don't know any mainstream show that would have a black woman with a banjo explaining the banjo's origins to a bunch of black kids. You know, that came and went, and I was like, I can't believe nobody's made any notice of this. You know, it kind of drove me a little nuts. I was like, this is really progressive what he's allowed to happen on the show. So anyway, I was really, really, really impressed with that, and was just really grateful to be a part of it, because everybody on the set was incredible. You know, it was a great experience for me. They were all patient with me because I'd never done TV before. And, you know, I say overall it was a really great experience. And I'm proud of the work I did on that show. And they let me submit my songs to sing. And they picked my songs a lot of the times. I co-wrote a lot of stuff with Dirk Powell. And overall, it was a really positive experience.
What else is there out there that you still want to do? I mean, musically first. I mean, have you ever wanted to have like a classic rock band or something? Or
not really. You know? I mean, you know, I've never been in this for the radio play, but man, having like a number one hit
wouldn't hurt, huh?
It brings a lot of power, you know, that kind of recognition. But I can't complain. You know, I've done about everything I could possibly do within a commercial, you know, music career to push the mission that I have. I'm very grateful for what I've been able to do. And I'm kind of ticking the boxes. I mean, I just, you know, I wrote the music for a ballet. I did that with Francesco. I'm writing an opera right now, composing that. And that's going to go up next year in Charleston. And it's about another North Carolina, you know, story that has been completely forgotten about, you know, by a lot of people, but is a really important story of, you know, Muslims in America. You know, Omar Ibn Said, who was a Senegalese Quranic scholar at 37, was captured, sold into slavery, and ended up in Charleston, and then, you know, made his way all the way up to Fayetteville, where he lived out the rest of his life, you know, and wrote his autobiography in Arabic. And, you know, this is all these stories that need to be told. And so as long as I'm able to continue to do that, you know, I don't know, I mean, I don't know how much I'll, you know, keep writing operas, but because it's a lot of work. But this one has been an amazing experience, you know. So as long as I can keep, you know, spreading out, I'm working with my nephew, who's a rapper, Demeanor. He's 21. It's amazingly talented, and we've been cooking this project, which I'm very, very excited about. So, you know, I'm always kind of wanting to step outside of, you know, what I'm known for. I can't ever do the same thing.
You could think of Rhiannon Giddens' career as a series of ever-widening circles, from the pop and R&B she sang as a child to the world music she creates and performs all over the globe. As she points out, music didn't used to be divided by category, not until it became part of the business of selling records and fed the desire to separate people by race. What you hear in Giddens' music is that circle getting wider and wider, taking in everything she's heard and sending it out through her voice and her hands as an expression of our shared history. That's a lot of load for a 3-minute song to bear. But what makes the load lighter is that she finds not just the tragedy in that history, but the joy in it too. She tells us our own story in notes and chords. And no matter if the story is 500 years old or from 5,000 miles away, somewhere in the music, we hear ourselves. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.